What we usually do here is have a little discussion session first before we meditate. So I would invite anybody with any question or anything on their mind to please speak up.
My question is, how do I free myself from attachments?
How do you free yourself from attachment? Well, there's a number of steps in the process, but the very first one, most important to begin with, is to recognize where there is attachment, what you're attached to, in the moment, not in sort of a general kind of philosophical way, but when you are actually experiencing emotions and thoughts that are the result of your attachments, and when in that moment, that's your opportunity to see, aha, this is an attachment that I have, and this is the effect that this attachment is having on me. So that's really where it begins. And from the point of recognizing what your attachments are, in general, what we can say is whenever those attachments come up, you're going to experience some degree of discomfort, dissatisfaction, a disturbance of what would otherwise be a contented and happy state of mind. Although sometimes when our attachments are in the form of greed, that's not so obvious, because we're all wrapped up in the thought of if we fulfill our desires, all of the pleasure that we're going to have. So, but if you look at it more closely, you realize that just to enter into that state of desire is to have lost the state of inner peace and contentment. But then there is a method that the Buddha taught. You know, he pointed out that we create our suffering because of our cravings, our desires and aversions and attachment. And that if you could recognize when they were present, and specifically doing that by recognizing when something is disturbing your inner peace of mind, that if when you recognize that, if you could just let go of that attachment or that craving, even for a moment, you would immediately experience the relief and the release that comes from that. And that has a strong effect on your mind to do that. Because even though you only let go of it for a moment, and even though it comes back, you know, it makes this imprint in your psyche that you'd be better off without that. And but other ways that other methods for helping us to not only recognize but let go of our attachment, keeping those precepts that we just went through, that's not a set of rules to follow like the Ten Commandments. What it is, it's a set of practices to hold those in your mind. And by holding those in your mind, you know, and for example, one of them says that not to take what is not freely given, which obviously means not go stealing things from other people. But it has many other shades of meaning too. And if you just keep that in mind as a precept, as a training rule, actually I just point out that we translate it into precept in English, but a more accurate translation of the original Pali that it was formulated in would be training rule rather than precept, because that's what it is, it's a practice. So if you keep that in your mind, then it will help to reveal to you all the different kind of subtle attachments that you have, and the way that desire and aversion arise, and the way that they disturb your peace of mind. the way that they lead you to speak and act in ways that contribute to the unhappiness of others. So practicing the precepts is a very powerful tool for recognizing your attachments and giving you the opportunity to let go of them. Then another method that the Buddha recommended and that he said he practiced himself was that when you recognize that you're having thoughts that are tainted in one way or another by desire, aversion, and attachment, to try to recall what the opposite mental states and the opposite kind of thoughts would be to that. And if you can, and of course when really strong emotions come up, and really strong desire or aversion is present, you won't be able to. But if you practice this, you'll eventually, those things will become not so strong and it'll be easier to do this. But if you can, if you're in a place where you can, not only let go of those unwholesome attitudes and thoughts, but at the same time, consciously and intentionally try to generate the wholesome counterpart to that. So if you're experiencing greed, for example, you're about to snatch the last brownie off the plate, just to use a trivial example. If you recognize, oh, that's my attachment, look what it's making me do, what would be the opposite? Well, it would be to take this and offer this brownie to somebody else, you know? So it's little things like that, but the little things lead you eventually to be able to deal with the much bigger things more effectively. That's just sort of a small summary of the methods that are inherent in this practice for doing that.
Thank you.
Do you have specific, if you have any specifics or anything like that?
I think it is a variety, and I try to get into it when it is about subjects that I don't want to let go on.
Yeah.
I thought that would be the easiest attempt to practice, and yeah. I found out it isn't.
Well, there is a really important psychological principle, you know, which if you try to suppress or resist or overcome these feelings and attachments by force of will, it doesn't work. As a matter of fact, what happens is you resist and suppress now, and it comes up again a little bit later, and you resist and suppress then. But, you know, that at some point you exhaust your willpower and you succumb. And the resistance hasn't really, all it is you can momentarily drive these things underground, but you haven't changed anything.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than trying to drive away something like that, it's actually far more productive to just, if you can observe it objectively, not identifying with it, but just observe it, say, oh, okay, this is what's there, this is what I'm feeling. Not try to deny it. But, of course, to the degree that you can restrain what you might say or do out of it, of course you should, you know, obviously you should do that, right? But instead of saying, well, oh, I shouldn't feel this way and try to make it into something different, observe it mindfully.
Mm-hmm.
And observe the effects it has. Observe how it makes you feel in your body. Observe how it makes you feel psychologically. Allow yourself to be fully aware of the consequences of the speech and action that might flow out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That will all have a strong effect of weakening the force behind these things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, there's a saying that's sometimes repeated, what you resist persists.
Yeah.
And that there's a certain degree of truth in that, and you need to keep that in mind. When I was talking about the Buddhist practice of replacing unwholesome thoughts with wholesome thoughts, you know, that becomes appropriate when you are actually able to you've already been able to look at and dissociate, and instead of saying, you know, I am angry or I am filled with desire or whatever it happens to be, if you can say objectively, oh, there's that emotion arising, and when you can succeed in saying, let me just let go of it, and you are able to let go of it, not suppressing it, just you let it be there and it just kind of evaporates. That's the point, that now you're free to reconsider the situation. If it involved another person and it was generating anger, then this is the opportunity to see what happened in a different light and perhaps instead feel patience, understanding, compassion for the person rather than anger and resentment.
That helps a lot. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's so many varieties of attachment that like your whole life is filled with different examples of how you want things to be, and that's a form of attachment, isn't it?
It is, that where things happen one way and you want them to happen another way, and then it makes you upset. Yeah, that's attachment.
Expectation? The expectation, when you expect something.
When you you expect something to happen in a particular way. And, of course, you've done it to yourself, right? you created the circumstance in your mind that this is how I believe it should be, and this is the way it is, but I don't want to accept that. And then you feel bad about it.
And I think there's sort of like, you know, when I was really young, it's like you give away all your things thinking, oh, I'm going to be not attached to all this stuff.
And
then it turns out that really you did need an alarm clock and you have to buy another or something. That there's like, you know, kind of a false sense of, oh, I'm not attached to that. Well, you know, it's almost like silliness or something.
Well, it's an attachment to an idea that causes you to...
attachment to an idea.
That causes you to behave in a way that doesn't make sense, you know?
Right.
You have this idea that, you know, I am going to be this wonderful, non-attached person, this sort of hidden agenda, and anybody that recognizes that's going to admire me so much. And I'm going to have so much self-esteem because I walk through the world knowing that I'm not attached. So, here, take my alarm clock. And then, of course, you can't get up in time to go to work. But there's attachment to people we love. There's attachment to all kinds of things that are pleasurable and enjoyable. What's the harm in that attachment?
Yeah, what is the harm in attachment to people that you love? When is it a harmful thing?
Well, when do you think? When does it become obvious that it's harmful?
It creates disharmony. When things are not, not vibrating right.
Yes, if you're attached to somebody else, I think this is what you're referring. If you're attached to somebody else, and then you have a disagreement and they get angry at you, you know, or you feel rejected by them, or they decide to go off with some other friend instead, then you realize, aha, that's the downside of the attachment. Or when they die.
I guess when you think it's going to be permanent or bring lasting satisfaction or lasting, any kind of lasting happiness or satisfaction, when you forget that it's impermanent and unsatisfactory on some level.
That on the one hand, you can see that to be attached to anything is to set yourself up for pain. If you lose it, or if something happens that makes you afraid you're going to lose it, or put you in a situation where you feel like you need to fight to hold on to what you're attached to. I mean, all of these things are kind of obvious. You can see that any form of attachment, even when it involves loving someone else or loving your job or loving where you live or anything like that, you're setting yourself up for suffering that is related to the loss of that. So that's one aspect of it. What we often don't realize is that the degree to which we're attached and clinging can take away from the satisfaction that we experience in those things that we love. So, you know, when you're completely unattached, then the totality of your being can embrace the person or the job or the place or the experience of the moment. It can embrace the experience of the moment totally, which means that whatever enjoyment and satisfaction it affords is going to be experienced to the greatest degree possible. To whatever degree there is attachment, there is some part of your mind that knows that the experience is going to end, or fears that it is going to end and not be repeatable, or that whatever it is that you have is lost. So to whatever degree, small or large, there is a part of your mind that is in that space of attachment, you are not fully present with, you're not even experiencing as fully and with as great a degree of satisfaction as you can. I mean, to the degree that we fear death, we cannot experience life fully. For that matter, to the degree that we fear what might happen tomorrow, we can't experience life today fully. So there's this more subtle aspect of attachment, which, I mean, the flip side of that is to the degree that you can let go of attachment, you can more fully embrace whatever experience that life brings to you and whatever happens. If you don't have expectations, if you don't have attachment to things being in a particular way or being able to hold on to things, then it's going to be much easier for you to flow with what happens and be totally present and experience it fully. And to the extent that being alive, being conscious, being able to experience things is a positive thing, then you're going to be able to embrace that more fully.
And doesn't that have something to do with the I, me, mine that we talk about too?
Well, yeah, that is the root of attachment. I mean, yeah, I've spoken about that many times. I'd be happy to hear somebody else talk about why craving and attachment are rooted in the notion of being a separate self.
You can't hear it too many times.
That's right. I want to hear it now.
And then there's the other side. For example, with my parents, they are kind of my attachment.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am their attachment.
Yes.
And being their attachment makes me really uncomfortable, and I think that is part of my guilt trip.
Part of your...
guilt.
Your guilt.
The feeling that I have towards them.
Oh, yeah, that's a very common kind of dynamic, and especially between parents and children. that they're attached to you, and you in turn feel responsible, right? And then, of course, if your heart moves you in this direction and they think you should go in that direction, and you have a conflict, you have guilt, and it's their attachment to you is making you unhappy because you're responding to it. Of course, that's because your attachment to them, and you feel like you want them to be happy, and you don't want to be responsible for them being unhappy. And so all these dynamics are present.
So how do I free myself from that? I mean, it's really uncomfortable and ties me down, and like I can't fly because I haven't found a way yet to deal with that comfortably.
Well, that is a good example. That's a good specific. So what you have to do is to examine, as I said, the attachment, examine it objectively rather than identifying with it, and allow yourself to become more fully aware of the totality of the situation. I mean, this attachment perspective sort of focuses in and it leaves out a whole lot of other things. And you want to bring those other things into it so that you can allow your mind to start to shift to the degree that you're just narrowly focused on the idea that, well, I'd like to do this, but if I do, then they'll be unhappy and you feel guilt. The larger picture is that it has a variety of components to it, but one is for you to be the best person that you can be, lead the best life you have, you may have to do things and go in directions and make choices that will disappoint your parents. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth of it. When you are identifying with the guilt and the feeling of responsibility, then that's just kind of a vague notion that doesn't quite really enter into the mental processing of the moment. So you've got to separate yourself from the feelings of guilt and responsibility so that you're seeing your needs and your responsibility to be the best person that you can be at exactly the same, from exactly the same perspective as you see your attachment and their attachment and that whole dynamic. And it's not so much about what at an intellectual level you understand, although you can use your intellect to make all the different facets of the situation as clear as possible. That's a good thing to do. But just understanding intellectually that, well, I need to live my own life, I can't base my behavior on the needs of somebody else. Just the intellectual understanding of that, the most that you can get out of that is you can, through force of willpower, alter your behavior temporarily and subsequently experience strong feelings of guilt arising out of it. Instead, if you just allow yourself to be as fully conscious and aware of the reality that's revealed through this understanding, that will penetrate down to these more primitive parts of your mind that are driving this whole thing, that are driving the guilt and everything. When you do that, it doesn't matter if you still do something, you know, initially you may still do things to please your parents. That doesn't matter if in the entire process of doing that, you're constantly recognizing that, well, here I am, behaving in this way. I don't need to, I really shouldn't, it's not really to their benefit, certainly not to mine, you know, even while you're doing it. Because the work is being done at the deeper level of your mind that's going to pay off later on, another time, when you'll choose not to. And you may still have some arising of the same feelings of inner conflict, but not at all to the degree that you would if you just had made an intellectual decision and were forcing yourself to behave, to ignore these other feelings. And that's all right. When that happens, you examine that in the same way. You say, okay, I'm having these feelings. Please come in and join us. If you say to yourself, okay, I did what I felt like was best for me, but now I am experiencing these feelings. And if you can examine that whole thing from the same perspective of wisdom, then eventually it's going to liberate you from the compulsions that arise out of these attachments. Now there's another part of this too. You might look at your parents' attachments and you might recognize that, well, to the degree that I can make them aware that they'd be better off not clinging to these ideas, I can make them happier in a much better way than I can by trying to do everything the way they want all the time. So that sort of moves you to a whole new level of acting with skillful means and speaking with skillful means. And the more skillful you become, the more successful you'll be at communicating that perspective in a way that's actually helpful to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is an example, just one example. All of us, our lives are filled with these situations where there's an underlying dynamic that keeps pushing us to speak and act in ways that aren't really in our best interest, or for that matter, anybody else's. You know, and so it's just the one example. But what there's so many of these; they permeate our lives. And part of the dissatisfaction we experience in life is we go through our daily life so much of the time on automatic pilot, and the programming behind the automatic pilot is that sort of thing, that set of shoulds and should nots and guilt and desire and I don't like that and all that kind of stuff. Yes, Annie?
So, an example, you know, if we knew how the Buddha felt about leaving in the middle of the night, and he was really following something that he had to follow, which was totally different than what was expected of him, completely. So what do we know about how he looked at that compared to what you've just been talking about?
We don't really know very much at all. But when he left home, he wasn't enlightened yet. And he had been groomed to take over his father's position. This was a time in India where there are all these little minor fiefdoms, and there was always war. So he saw himself being groomed to be in the position of being responsible for the well-being of his people and having to make war with other local groups. At this time, there was a lot of conquering and combining taking place, and so the war was pretty much constant. You know, he might have left just in the attitude of, this is not for me, I've had enough of this, you know. We don't know.
I guess what I would like to know is how he resolved that later. What came out of his teachings that talked about that?
Well, what he did later, after his enlightenment, he went back home again. And his aunt who had raised him, mm-hmm. and his wife who he had abandoned, and his father and everybody else, from what we can tell, they did exactly what you would expect, which was to try to make him feel really bad about abandoning the men and everything else. And one of the instances that is recounted in the sutras is that his wife said, there's your son, Rahula. Go give him his inheritance, you know, basically saying, see, you walked away, you had no consideration for the well-being of your family and your son, usual kind of guilt trip sort of thing. And the Buddha said, okay, and went and ordained Rahula as a bhikkhu. Gave him his inheritance. which, of course...
From his experience.
From his experience.
Yeah.
Which initially obviously upset Rahula's mother and everybody else in the family. But what's very interesting is before he left, his father and his wife and his stepmother, all of these people took precepts and began to follow his teaching. This is the skillful means part of it. He was able to come back with his own clarity and actually succeed in communicating to these people well enough that they gave up trying to guilt trip him and instead became followers of his teaching. That's pretty impressive.
So they saw something
that
in him that made them be able to accept without bringing the past into it.
That's right. And there's not a lot of details provided about that. Throughout the sutras, there's a lot of other teachings that to one degree or another bear on this. There's one sutra where a woman, her child died, and because Buddha had this reputation of being a holy man, she brought the child to the Buddha and said, please, can you bring him back to life, you know, sobbing and everything. And the Buddha, rather than saying yes or no, said, first, go to every house in the village and locate one where nobody has lost somebody that's died. And the woman eventually came back and realized that this is the nature of life. Everyone dies and we lose the ones that we love. So there's a lot of different teachings in there where he's pointing out to you. There's one of them in particular where he says, to love somebody is to create your own future suffering. And he's talking about the sort of love that involves attachment. He's not talking about more pure, unattached, selfless love. But to love somebody in a way that creates attachment is to create your own future suffering. So those are the things that come to my mind.
So if you live your life with integrity, that will lessen whatever way you've been taught to feel about doing something different than what's
That's right.
on the road.
And a really important thing when we're talking about relationships with other people and like with parents and things like that, you need a lot of compassion because there is, if we feel bound to our parents, and then we try to liberate ourselves from that binding, there's a tendency to do, well, you know what, adolescents and young people, when they separate, they'll get into this rejection, and they'll even try to be hurtful in order to make that separation. There's a tendency to do that. But a more mature point of view is that when you realize that you have your own life to lead, but to do whatever you need to do from a place of understanding and compassion. And compassion doesn't necessitate that you sacrifice your own well-being, but compassion has a tremendous influence on how you go about doing it and what you say. And also, how much of yourself you're willing to give and why, and to the degree to which you're doing it is out of love and compassion equally for yourself and for the other person. So compassion needs to come into any separation, because if compassion isn't there, then we resort to producing a certain amount of pain in order to bring about the separation. And it's not necessary. It's not necessary to cause pain. Then, of course, the other side of it is it's easy to say, oh, well, I need to be compassionate, and forget that you need to be equally compassionate to yourself as to anyone else. It's not a question of denying your own needs and your own well-being for the sake of somebody else, but compassion is what's best for everybody involved. And so, you know, be compassionate for your parents while being compassionate for yourself, and be equally compassionate for both. So then you're not sacrificing your own needs for their sake, nor are you causing them any more unhappiness or dissatisfaction strictly speaking, you're not causing them any dissatisfaction at all. You're doing your best to minimize the unhappiness that they'll create for themselves. And if you can make them aware that they're creating their own unhappiness and how, then perhaps they'll choose not to do so. Yes, hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. We had a little pestering, millennium redbird pestering the window this morning. And after Marian left, I had made the decision not to come. But he kept coming to the window and trying to get in, even after Marian left. And he even came to the bedroom window and just kept trying to get in. And I finally saw that maybe this is a sign from nature that this is the place I needed to be this morning. You really believe that our higher powers, or that our loved ones have passed, because I'm grieving the loss of a son, and now I'm going to, tomorrow I'm leaving to take my father through the final stages of his life. I just got the phone call. And detaching and moving on. Do you think that, is it true that I just, you know, the signs have been coming from nature? And how do you feel about that?
Could you ask me more specifically? I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
A little bird just kept coming to fly into the window today. Mm-hmm. And I had changed my plans of not coming this morning.
Yeah. How do I feel about an incident that happened that caused you, even though you decided not to hear, to come here, to change your mind and come? Well, you mentioned some other greater power. And yes, I do believe in that people think of it in different forms. People call it God, or there's many other names, and there's different ways that people think of that. I do not think of it as something outside of yourself. I don't think of it as a separate, that power emanates from some sort of separate entity, some being who you are not and who is not you, and who is somehow wiser and is somehow manipulating the universe so that these signs and messages will be sent to you to be interpreted. I do believe that we all have what's called in my tradition, a Buddha nature, that our own true nature is the same nature of the Buddha, an enlightened being. Or another way of thinking of that is that we all have within us the divine nature, that in fact the experience that we have of being this limited, separate individual is just an illusion. That our true nature is this Buddha nature or this divine nature, which possesses infinite wisdom. And that being the case, some other being or force or power doesn't need to manipulate the world and make some bored bird say, how come I keep wanting to go into this window? It's not what I want to do. I'm going to eat some seeds just so that you'll get the message. Rather, life provides infinite number of opportunities for the wiser part of you to get the message through and say, you know, rethink what you're doing or reconsider or take a new direction. So to my way of thinking, who knows why the bird was flying in your window, but your own Buddha nature, your own divine nature, or whatever it is, your own inner wisdom, took that as an opportunity to guide you. So that's how I understand that. But you know, that's just a point of view. That's my point of view, which for all kinds of reasons works best for me. And anybody else's point of view that's different, that works better for them, is quite fine too, because all that's important is if the whatever point of view you adopt works for you and produces a good and wholesome type of result. Did I succeed in answering the right question?
Yes, you did.
So I'm glad that you came, and I hope that some of the things that we've talked about will be helpful to you. So you're leaving tomorrow, your father is dying, is that correct? Okay, there is. As sad as it is, and it's a wonderful opportunity for you and your father, and there's so much to be learned from it. I don't know about your relationship with your father, but ideally a father teaches us all kinds of things because they have more experience, and so as children we rely on our parents to provide us with guidance. What your father is going through, you're going to go through. So this is your father's last great lesson to you. And there's so much that you can learn from it. And there's also so much that you can give back and exchange. So this, sad as it is a wonderful opportunity.
When you were talking about, for example, of parents, and I see how I take responsibility in my life for things that aren't my responsibility. When you talked about allowing them to choose not to make themselves that unhappy, rather than I would be making someone unhappy, they're choosing that for themselves, and I see a lot of places where, you know, I want to hold that responsibility for other people's happiness or other people's choices or the way, wanting relationships or wanting situations to unfold so there's no conflict, so there's no unpleasantness, so that things are satisfactory and comfortable. And, I'm just looking at that. And that, I guess that attachment that I have, to somehow being a person who can control other people's choices or other people's situations or happiness. And it's just interesting to get a bit more understanding of that, of you say, be clear of my own life and my own path. And it seems often when I'm trying to control the way things unfold or control other people's happiness in relationship to me, that I'm almost, it's disrespectful in a lot of ways, that I'm almost not creating opportunities for them to grow, for them to allow things to unfold. So I'm just interested in your comments.
Well, you see, we can, if we are truly selfless, we can lead our lives in such a way that we're being of service to other people. And that's a good thing. But it requires the wisdom. If you're going to be of service to other people, you have to know what's really good for them. Right? And a lot of times what people want isn't what's really good for them. If the only effect of your action is not only to temporarily satisfy someone else's desire and attachment, but also has the effect of reinforcing that and making it even stronger in them, then you do have to question whether doing that is the best thing, or whether maybe there's some modified way of doing that's more wholesome. At the same time, even if you are selfless, like the Buddha, we assume, was a totally selfless being, but he had as much respect for his own body and his mind as he did anybody else's, and treated them equally. So even though you're selfless, it doesn't mean that you're going to do things to try to satisfy somebody else's desires and needs at the expense of the well-being of your body and mind, which is not the same as attachment to your sense of self. Mm-hmm. It's just recognizing that. I suppose you could say, in the sense of the Buddha, if the Buddha didn't take care of himself, he wouldn't have been around for 45 years to keep on teaching and helping other people. So part of his fulfilling his mission of helping others was taking adequate care of himself so that he could do that. So those are things to keep in mind. That first of all, just because something is going to bring someone else happiness in the moment doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing for them. And it's true, you know, as Shanti Deva said, all of the suffering in the world is a result of trying to make ourselves happy, and all of the happiness in the world comes from trying to make others happy. So by doing things for others, you're really doing the best thing that you possibly can for yourself, if you're doing it selflessly. You know, if you are openly and freely sharing of your own time and energy and everything else sincerely for the benefit of other people, you're taking very good care of your own self, and you're going to have a tremendous feeling of satisfaction from that. So, but that's not going to happen if you're in a situation where you're giving away your alarm clock and you have to, mm-hmm. and it means you're not going to be able to go for work in the morning. Well, I mean, it could be a situation where somebody else's need was greater and you deliberately said, well, okay, this is the consequences, but, you know. But it has to be, there has to be that mindful consideration of the impact of what you do on yourself. And if having an alarm clock and waking up in the morning and going to work means you keep your job and allows you to help a whole lot of other people as a result of it, give a second thought to giving away your alarm clock.
Yeah, I think that's often what comes up for me is the short term the short-term happiness.
Yeah.
But obviously myself often, but of others as well. I'm not using discerning to really get clear that this isn't actually a kindness, supporting someone in a direction that makes them happy short-term, when really having more awareness of,
yeah,
more understanding that, that I guess when in treating, in respecting my wholesome needs, that actually, probably all the time, that is actually really respecting other people's needs more honestly than the very short-term kind of supporting and giving. So thank you.
Anybody have anything else to, if they want to mention?
I have some ointment, like that attachment right there is to the happiness of other people. Like when you, what is the high there for you that you really like, you know, you're doing this not for them, but for you, because when they're happy, that's what gives me the high, you know, like, well, even if it hurts them a little bit afterwards. But then you're not there for that. Mm-hmm. You're only there for this high that it will give me, that, oh, they're happy and I contribute. You know, like, oh, I'm part of this.
Well,
that's what I feel like sometimes.
Making somebody else happy so that it will make yourself happy is still a selfish approach. Although it's a lot better than doing something that makes somebody else unhappy. Right? It still has that component of selfishness. In terms of your motivation, what is the intention behind your act? At the surface level, you say, oh, I'm going to do this for her to make her happy. Uh-huh. But the deeper level, it's, oh, if I make her happy, then I'll feel a lot better about myself. Then it's still selfish. The fact is that whatever you do that is good and beneficial to other people is going to produce mental pleasure in you. And there's nothing wrong with that. The only problem with the scenario we just described is that the root motivation wasn't the well-being of the other person, in which case our own happiness would just be a nice side effect, right? But rather it was what was driving. And that's all right. If that's where you are, if you're a person that is trying to make other people happy because it makes you feel good, that's where you start. That's good. If you can bring to that situation the wisdom that, well, it would be better if I could be doing this for their sake, and it would also be better if I wasn't so attached to making myself happy through their happiness, I probably would take better care of myself too. And I would show equal respect to myself, as we were just talking about, as the other person. To the degree which you're trying to get yourself a boost by making somebody else happy, you're very vulnerable to doing things that aren't good for you, that aren't beneficial for you, in order to bring about that happiness. So if that's where a person is, and they can recognize where they are, and they can be mindfully aware of it, then this gives them the opportunity to grow to the next level. So the principle is, you always start where you are, and it doesn't matter where you are. You start with the reality of who and what you are, and if the only reason you do things for other people is to make yourself happy, that's fine. Accept that and see if you can move beyond it.
But that's probably not. I mean, you, most people aren't doing things for other people to make yourself happy. They're doing things to make other people happy.
Mm-hmm. Most people, it's a mixture.
But you get an addiction to making other people happy.
Yeah.
I mean, I would describe it as somewhat of an addiction. Oh, good. I cooked another breakfast for somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
But there's always a mixture in that. Yeah, you may be doing it partly because it makes you happy, but you know, there is a natural goodness and love and compassion, kindness in our hearts anyway. So it would be only in the most neurotically driven behavior that there isn't that other part as well there. You know?
Well, very easily.
So really, you know, it's like the two things are already there. So we're just trying to move to more of one and less of the other.